Now, some of you may be uncomfortable with the fact that I have named names. Why don't you just say, it's been reported? Well, you may remember that in the pastoral epistles, Paul did not hesitate to name names of his opponents. Let me give you an example of that. In 1 Timothy chapter 1, the Apostle Paul says to Timothy, "This charge I entrust to you, Timothy, my child, in accordance with the prophecies freely made about you, by them you may wage the good warfare, holding fast the faith with a good conscience. By rejecting this, some have made shipwreck of their faith. Among them are Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I have handled over to Satan, that they may not taught not to blaspheme." In 2 Timothy chapter 2, he mentions another couple of individuals. He said, "But avoid irreverent babble, for it will lead people into more and more ungodliness, and their talk will spread like gangrene. Among them are Hymenaeus and Philetus, who have swerved from the truth, saying that the resurrection has already happened. They are upsetting the faith of some." And of course, you know that in Galatians, Paul did not hesitate to mention Peter was an object of his rebuke for his double standards. So the Bible is replete with the fact that names are named. Wayne Grudem was a professor at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School when I was a teacher there. When I was a student, pardon me. We are both graduates of Westminster Seminary, Philadelphia. In fact, a couple of years ago, Westminster had an alumni banquet, and Wayne and I sat next to each other. I was unaware of this happening at the time. So I know him. I have a high opinion of his work. He has written a systematic theology, which has become a fairly standard text in many theological seminaries. It carries glowing endorsements from a number of very high-profile evangelicals, including J.I. Packer and John Piper. In this theology, he says that the subordination of the Son is essential to his identity as the Son. In fact, he writes, "In this relationship, quote, between man and woman in marriage, we also see a picture of the relationship between the Father and the Son in the Trinity." And he goes on to say that just as the wife is to submit to her husband, so Christ has to submit in his eternal nature to the Father, and that the Spirit is like unto children born out of this relationship. That's not true. That's not even remotely true. In another one of Wayne's books, he makes this statement. He said, "The idea of headship and submission has always existed, for it is part of the eternal nature of God Himself. The Father's nature is that of the one who gives orders, and the Son is that of one who takes them." In other words, the nature of the Son differs from the nature of the Father. And we made the point last week, and I'll rehearse that this morning. Classical theologians have distinguished between what is called the ontological Trinity, from the word ontology, which means being. This refers to God as He is in His self, that within the nature of the ontological Trinity, there is co-equality. The nature of the Son and the nature of the Father are identical. They're not different, as is the Holy Spirit. Now, in what is known as the economical Trinity, how many of you studied home economics in high school? What does that refer to? Handling a household, managing the affairs. I mentioned the fact that my wife is, to use a Greek term, the oikumenos of our house. What is that? She's the steward. She handles the checkbook. Why should she do that? She's a math major. I brag about my wife. Did you know that she was 4 times voted math student of the year at San Diego State University? She never had anything less than a 4.0 grade point average. So why would I, who made C minuses in math, take over the bookkeeping for the house? No, my wife manages the accounts. She sees to it that bills are paid on time, and she sees to it that purchases are made within our budget. She keeps a very tight, and she'll say, "You can't spend but this month, money this week. I have to buy more books." Not this month, you're not. Anyway, she is the oikumenos. She is the one who handles the affair. When we talk about the economical Trinity, we're talking about the outworking of God's plan in human history. And so within the economical Trinity, when we hear of the Son becoming incarnate, he now submits himself to the will of the Father. Remember, in the Garden of Gethsemane, he would pray, "Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not my will, what will? The will of the eternal Son? No, the will of the incarnate Son." He has two wills in his incarnation. Now, if suddenly, within the ontological Trinity, the will of the Son is also subservient to the Father, there's a change taking place. I mentioned that at the Council of Nicaea, there were two Greek terms that were debated. Homoousios and hamaousios. You know, they sound almost the same. But the homoousios was the position of the Arians. They said that Christ had a nature similar to the Father. He's a little bit different. The Orthodox party, led by Athanasius, said, no, it's hamaousios. It's the same. I think unwittingly, people like Wayne Grudem and Bruce Ware have bought into a Homoian Christology. What is that? That is, the Son has somewhat of a different nature than the Father. And if that's the case, then we no longer have a Trinity. We have a tritheism. There are now three gods, and they're ranked differently. Now that is a serious error. And it will have long-term unintended consequences. Next week, I'm going to highlight a history lesson for you on how the rise of Unitarianism captured the most prominent Puritan pulpits in both England and America. How Harvard University, which was founded by the Puritans, who were loyal to the Westminster Standards, within the space of just a couple of generations, became totally Unitarian. How did that happen? Some of you may have heard of the great Puritan pastor, Richard Baxter. He pastored a church that, for over 40 years, was one of the stalwart Puritan churches in all of England. And yet, within 20 years after his death, the church became Unitarian. How does that happen? It doesn't happen overnight. Incrementally, things occur. Well, let's look at our text. First of all, the writer says, long ago. It kind of reminds you of Star Wars, doesn't it? Long ago in a galaxy far away. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke. Now, notice that God is speaking in both long ago and in the final revelation. The authority of the revelation is still God's revelation. He is speaking. But as I pointed out last week, it's incrementally. The unfolding of the drama of redemption occurs in steps. We're told in Galatians and Genesis 3 that the seed of the woman shall crush the head of the serpent. Now, we know, then, that something's going to happen in the human race in which this individual is going to come. Later on, we understand that God selects Abraham. It was out of Abraham that he shall bless the nations. And then one of Abraham's offsprings, Isaac will have Jacob, and Jacob will have 12 sons, and they will be the tribes of Israel. And we're told that out of one of these tribes, the seed will come. It's Judah. It's the tribe of Judah. And then later we learn he will come from the house of David. And so we read in the gospel accounts of the birth narratives of Christ, a census was compelled. And so Joseph, who was betrothed to Mary, had to go where? To the city of David. And that's where Christ was born. And so here we have this unfolding of God's purposes. But he says, but in these last days, then including our times, he has spoken to us by, and in the Greek text, it's son. It's simply son. Weos, a son. But we know who this is. This is Christ. This book of Hebrews is going to be dealing with contrast constantly. Contrasting the son with the angels, the son with Moses, the son with Levi, to show the superiority of the son. But he begins by telling us that he has spoken unto us by his son. And in his son, notice he says, whom he has appointed the heir, he is to receive the inheritance. And notice, this is the heir of all things. And it is through him that he created the world. Christ is the agent of creation because Christ is the creator. All things were made by Him. Without Him, not anything was made. This is talking about His eternal nature, not just what would happen later in the incarnation. And He is the heir of all things and through whom He created the worlds. He is also, notice this, the radiance of the glory of God. The new advocates of subordinationism are contending that the glory of the Father is different than the glory of the Son. Ever so slightly, it's different. That's not what this text says. This text says He is the exact radiance of the glory of God, the exact imprint of His nature. Listen, I'm going to use a Greek word again, ousias. You see it in hama ousias, amoi ousias. Each one of you are an ousias. You have a nature. Now, what is particular to your nature? You all have a will. Now, if we all decided we're going to go down to the Golden Corral and we're going to go through the smorgasbord, and each of us would be selecting foods based upon our likes and dislikes, our wills would be activated. We would choose some to eat Brussels sprouts and broccoli and liver. And others of us would gravitate toward frog legs and shrimp. We would all choose differently. Listen, if within the nature of God there is more than one will, there is a massive problem. This is not Trinitarianism. Within the nature of the one God, there is one nature, not degrees of natures, the Father having one that's better, and then the Holy Spirit comes tagging along somewhere. And Grudem actually says the Spirit is like a child in a family. No, He's not! As E.M. Gothlager says, this is bonkers. That's the Hebrew word for crazy. This is crazy. We cannot have this. And we're going to see here that not only is He the exact imprint of His nature, He upholds the universe by the word of His power. Do you know that Christ is the sustainer? That the atoms that keep this world and you in one part are the direct result of the activity of the pre-incarnate Son of God? Not some lesser being? Listen, in Philippians chapter 2, it's a great text. We looked at it a few months back. Where Paul says, let this mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who though He was in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal to God, but took to Himself the form of a servant. That's the incarnation. And what happened? And becoming obedient unto death. In Hebrews chapter 5, we're told He learned suffering. He suffered because He learned obedience. Listen, if obedience was something that goes back into eternity, the Son is now, where's He learning obedience? He's always been in that capacity. No, this is in His capacity as the mediator. And so we cannot say, and this is the problem. You remember the psalmist has God rebuking the people when he said, you thought I was like you, didn't you? Look, God is not like us. We can say, truthfully, that in some ways human beings are like God. That's true. We're made in His image. But it is not right to say God is like us. This is the errors of Jehovah's Witnesses and the errors of Mormonism. God has a body and He procreates with that. That's nonsense. You know, it reminds me of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. That's Frankenstein theology. And that came out of the fertile imagination of Joseph Smith. And that's why Mormonism is anti-Christian, because it's anti-Trinitarian. Trinitarian is at the core of Christianity. But not just any kind of Trinitarianism. Not just the kind that the early church had to combat constantly. I'm going to have an insert for you next week of the various heresies that plagued the early church. Sabellianism, modalism, Apollinarianism, Nestorianism. All these were attempts to modify the language of the Trinity. And this is something that people have a tendency to do. It was the great church father. I've been reading this week a number of the early church fathers, the Cappadocians. Two of them were brothers, Basil, and there were two Gregories, Gregory of Nazianzus and Gregory of Cappadocia. But they're brilliant. They are just brilliant. And to read them, you understand why Calvin was so fascinated by them. If you read the Institutes, one of the things you'll come away with is Calvin knew his church fathers. He quotes them extensively. Not only the well-known ones, but the lesser-known ones. And he quotes them at length. He knows the church fathers. And I'm afraid that most of us today wouldn't know who they were from the dark side of the moon. Here a few weeks back, someone said they invited a relative to our church and they complained that we were too Catholic. What? Oh, you're citing creeds and confessions and all this. That sounds Catholic. We're not Catholic enough. We should be citing them more. And by the way, if you read the Institutes, Calvin never refers to his opponents within the Roman Church as Catholics. He said the term is too dear to him. He calls them papists, not Catholics. We are Catholic. We affirm and hold to the church creeds as set forth in Nicaea and Chalcedon and otherwise. But let's keep in reading here. And after making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. That doesn't mean that he is now taking it easy. To sit down at the right hand means all dominion and authority has been entrusted to him. It is King Jesus that we now serve. And to say he made purification. If you have an NIV, I really don't like how they translated this. They have after he made provisions for purification. No, he didn't make provisions. He made purification. And this is because when they were translating NIV, they had representative scholars from various denominations, and they wanted to make sure that the Arminians didn't get offended. And so they stuck in a hypothetical atonement by translating. In fact, S. Lewis Johnson, who was on the committee, said he was vigorously opposed to that translation because that's not what the text says. It says he made purification, that is, his atoning work. So now we are talking about Christ in his work as the mediator. We're talking about the one who came in the fullness of time, born of a woman, born under the law, that he might redeem us. Now we're talking about the economical outworking of the plan of God in human history. But if we read that back in to the eternal nature of God, we do a great disservice and we create problems. You've all heard of unintended consequences. You know, people have decided that we got a problem, so let's fix it. And again, an illustration of this. When they first settled Australia, it was a penal colony. They decided to introduce rabbits because there wasn't a whole lot of game there. And when the space of just a few years, they had a problem because rabbits multiply. You understand that? And within the space of a generation, the whole country was overrun with rabbits because there were no natural predators or very few of them. It was an unintended consequence. It's not supposed to happen. And now and then you hear about some project in which they've got a problem with some kind of algae in some particular river. And so, hey, we have a problem. We have a solution. We have these particular fish that will get rid of that. Well, then the fish become a problem. So they introduce something else to get rid of that problem. Unintended consequences. Ideas have consequences. And theology certainly has consequences. You start with the wrong doctrine of God and everything will go off the rails really quickly and soon. This is why sound doctrine is so important. This is why it is so important that we think about God as he has revealed himself to us. It is my prayer that these two men in particular, because they have been in the forefront, would receive a rebuke justly and rightly and amend their ways. Unfortunately, that is not happening. They are digging in. And a war is brewing, the outcome of which I cannot begin to imagine. Let me ask you to pray for the situation. Pray for all involved. It is sometimes difficult not to misrepresent your opponents and to charge them with views that they would repudiate. Like I said, if you read through Wayne Grudem's theology, there's a lot of good things in it. It's substantive, it's well-researched, but then there's a problem, and here is the problem. May God grant us all humility as we study this theme. As the elders and deacons come forward now, let us be prepared to remember what the eternal Son of God did when he took to himself a body and became obedient unto death, even death on the cross.